And welcome to those of you who are our guests this morning. One afternoon in the fall, about 5 years ago, we received here at the office an email from a gentleman who didn't tell us really where he lived, but he his subject was questions. And where it had a place for importance, he put high. And so I read as quickly and answered as quickly as we could his series of questions. He began this way. I've been doing some Bible study recently and was hoping you'd be able to answer a few questions that I'm struggling with. Look at that phrase, a few questions that I'm struggling with. It occurs to me from considering the nature of the questions that very likely they are ones that other people have wondered about too. I'm familiar with a lot of the questions that we already have as a church. It's helpful sometimes to think of questions that other people have. And I thought because of this, I might take the rest of these Sundays in September and discuss with you some of the answers to the questions this man sent us. We will read them to you a week at a time. They do go somewhere, and when we get to the end of it, you kind of wonder if maybe there was a point, another point to it, but I think it will be helpful to each one of us. For example, here's his first one. Number one, why should I go to church? I don't know the tone of voice that he wrote it in. That's my voice. I mean, what's the ultimate goal that I'm trying to achieve? Is there a meaning or a reason why I should go to church? You know, admitting it to ourselves, he isn't the only one to answer or to want an answer to that question or to wonder about it, is he? For one thing, it's getting harder and harder for the church to compete with secular society for the body and mind of its members. Even on Sunday morning, there are a lot of distractions. That'll probably get worse and not better. For another thing, we're too busy. Most of us are run so ragged by the pace of the week that we've just been through that it gets pretty easy to resist appointments that require further time and energy from us. Dan Williams down at Harding begins every one of the chapels at the beginning of every school year by trying to remind the university students, now that many of them are away from home for the first time, they have to choose to get up and go to church. He says, one Sunday morning, Ralph's wife, Margie, was downstairs dressed and ready to leave for church, but Ralph was nowhere to be seen. Finally, she went back upstairs to the bedroom, and there he was, still sacked out in the bed. And she asked him, "Why aren't you getting ready for church?" And Ralph answers, "Oh, I just don't feel like going today. I'd rather stay in bed." And she says, "Ralph, you need to get out of that bed right now and get dressed and let's go." "No." And he says, "I told you, Margie, I just don't feel like it. Give me one good reason why I should go to church." Margie says, "I'll give you three. First, the Bible commands it. Second, you'll feel better after you do. And third, you're the preacher." You may not realize that all of us have times when we don't feel like coming enthusiastically and meeting another hour on the Lord's Day. And one thing more, and maybe this is more insidious than the other two, a more and more common assumption in our culture is that spirituality is an individual matter, and that it's for our personal benefit, and that we can tend to it by ourselves and in our own way, and therefore we don't need the church. And so it may be that my responses to our friend who asked that day and elaborated on just a bit and illustrated, hopefully, will help some of us with things that we're struggling with about this too. Here's my premise. The reasons to go to church that the New Testament gives, the New Testament's reasons for meeting with the church when it comes together, can be summarized by three basic statements. And I want to try to leave these three statements in your heart and mind today. First, we should go to church to remember the Lord and to thank Him for what He's done to make us a people for His own possession to start with. Watch those two main words, to remember and to thank. To remember and to thank. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verses 23 through 26, a passage which is very often read in our assemblies on the first day of the week as we observe the Lord's Supper. And then the context surrounding this paragraph is a good illustration of what I mean right here. It says, "For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when He was betrayed, took bread, and when He had given thanks, He broke it and said, 'This is My body which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of Me.' In the same way, He also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in My blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of Me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until He comes.'" Sometimes passages that are most familiar with us need to be rethought a little more carefully, and this perhaps is one. Be aware that the whole section of the letter where this is found is concerned with what happens when, as Paul puts it, when you come together as a church, chapter 11, verse 18. And when you get over to chapter 14, verse 23 and 26, you'll notice that he's still talking about what happens when we come together as the church. This paragraph is about what happened one night. The night when Jesus gathered together with his apostles, Luke 22 and 15, and when he said to them, "I have earnestly desired to eat this with you before I suffered." We're talking about doing something that happened when Jesus wanted to be with his disciples as he does it. And it turns out to be the same night when he's betrayed by one of them. And then later, Paul, who wasn't there that night, as you know, has received this from the Lord specifically, and Paul has delivered it to the Lord's people as something to be done among them in order to remember going forward. Now we know from 1 Corinthians 16 that the church apparently was coming together on the first day of the week. We know from other New Testament passages like Acts 20 and verse 7 that this was the practice of the church. And we know from history that they did this on the first day of the week. But what does "in remembrance of Me" mean? And why is it "when you come together"? Verse 33. Well, it's remembrance when we come together because it's recognizing the ransom price that was paid for all of us. And it's appreciating the benefits that we participate in or share in together. We're remembering that we've been bought, and then we've been given some things. It's remembering when we come together because it's respecting the covenant that was established on the basis of the Lord's life. And it's reaffirming our partnership and the privileges and obligations of that covenant. It's a renewal of loyalty in that way. And it's remembering when we come together because it's realizing the Lord's continuing fellowship with His people, His presence with us. And it's gratefully and hopefully and expectantly reorienting our lives to His rule in this new week ahead of us. In that way, coming to church to remember and to thank has a tremendous impact on us. What Andy just read as we observed the supper this morning, remembered Christ and asked us to not look just to our own interests either. And that's a perfect application of what we're talking about. And even though the communion belongs in the community of the Lord's people on the first day of the week, there's no doubt that grateful remembering is the appropriate spirit with the rest of the Lord's meetings as well. Revelation 1, in verses 5 and 6, says, "To Him who loves us and has freed us from our sins by His blood and made us a kingdom and priest to His God and Father, to Him be glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen." So the first thing we say is that we respond to what we know Christ has done for us by remembering and thanking Him together. The second reason we should go to church to be a positive spiritual influence on our brothers and sisters in the Lord and to be influenced by them. In Hebrews chapter 11, there is another familiar passage, and it's one which states just what I've just said, just as much as that, as the rationale for our meeting together. Hebrews 10, beginning at verse 22, has this paragraph. It says, "Let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience, and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for He who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as the habit of some is, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near." Now you think about this for a minute. Look at the passage. Our faith and our hope and our love are all directed toward the Lord. And that's as it should be. But somehow, our full assurance and our holding fast and our love turned into good works also requires one another. Brother Everett Ferguson, in commenting about this, says, "In community there is strength. Individual weaknesses are overcome through the encouragement of others." That's what Andy mentioned a while ago. "People need one another. And the meetings of the Lord's church provide the opportunity for learning needs, planning to meet them, and acting together. Forsaking the assembly is not a sin against an institution, but against brothers and sisters to whom we owe mutual edification and fellowship." Steve Tandy, our brother out in Wichita, is a witty, sort of tongue-in-cheek writer. Always enjoy reading after him. He's offered an illustration of the kinds of intention that our meeting together assumes. He says his idea got started when he saw how KissCam worked at a Wichita State University basketball game. And he said, for those of you who haven't been to one, KissCam is a promotional gimmick used during timeouts. Some banks sponsor it so they get the name on their Jumbotron every time it's played, and the cameraman looks for couples who are sitting together, and then they put their picture on the big screen and everybody starts cheering, and the couples are supposed to kiss each other as they realize it's them up there. Some people go with a polite peck, some get fairly exuberant, and occasionally, someone refuses to play along. The producer says we look for couples that look the most likely to kiss, but occasionally we pick the wrong ones, like a brother and a sister or something. Steve said, I said that's where my super cool idea started, with KissCam. But here's how I made the stunning leap from ball games to churches. I remembered that the Greek root for worship actually means to kiss toward. It expressed the adoration we offer to God. So why not recognize that? Now you understand he's kidding here, but why not recognize that by running a worship cam during service? I think it might be out of line to get a sponsor, so we'll just do it pro bono for our edification. All we need to do is a camera up front, probably hidden would do best, and a remote control to move it around, and then randomly throughout the service, we could flash a person up on the big screens. It'd be brilliant. How inspiring will it be to see a high-def image of someone's joy-filled face as they sing praises to God? How motivating to catch someone with a furrowed brow studiously digesting the word during the sermon? Won't communion be enriched by discerning other parts of the body as they truly remember with a grateful love written all over their faces? How about seeing the thankfulness in the older widow's eyes, thankful she has something to give as she puts two mites into the plate cheerfully? Isn't this worship cam sounding better all the time? And then he says, I admit I've tried to think of drawbacks. How embarrassing would it be to stumble on someone snoring or tweeting or clipping their fingernails, or slouched down reading a novel on Kindle? He says, I guess some churches might have to be careful about such members, but surely not us. We're aware that worship cam is on all the time. I read of a coach who would tell his players that some people are fountains and other people are drains. And he had urged all of his guys to be the former, to be the fountains, the givers, and not the drains who sap all that out from everyone else. And I would say with regard to coming to church, if we'll go to be fountains, We'll find ourselves resupplied with the resources for being a blessing. So there's the second reason. Third, we should go to church to express our identity as a people who belong to the Lord and our unity in offering spiritual sacrifices to Him. Unity is an easy thing to talk about, But it's hard to move beyond simply the circle of our closest and dearest friends, even in a room where the whole church is gathered together. There is one thing that expresses that unity. It's the assembled church with a holy priesthood offering up a sacrifice of praise. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5, verses 9 and 10, there's this example. This, you yourselves are like living stones being built up as a spiritual house. In other words, a spiritual temple. To be a holy priesthood. Priest is never used of the New Testament church in the singular. It's always a priesthood, a plural. All of us together. Not me, but all of us together. To offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. A little farther down. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for His own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, now you have received mercy. We were not a people. We were a bunch of different individuals from different backgrounds, races, whatever else. But now we are a people. And we, as a people, have a purpose. And it's to proclaim the excellencies of Him whose people we are. And we serve our purpose by being a spiritual temple, that implies we're together, in which we function as a holy priesthood by offering up spiritual sacrifices that are acceptable to the one we're serving, acceptable to Him. Brother Ferguson again shows that the very word church is loaded with the assumption that this will be occurring on a regular basis. He says the designation ecclesia, church, called out, calls attention to the importance of meeting together for the nature of the church. The church, by definition, is an assembly. It is people who meet together on a regular basis. The word ecclesia identifies the people of God as assembled. The church exemplifies that it is indeed the church when it comes together. In assembly, the church becomes itself. It becomes conscious of itself, confesses itself to be a distinct entity, shows itself to be what it is, a community of people gathered by the grace of God, dependent on Him and honoring Him. The assembly allows the church to emerge in its true nature, a redeemed community. I believe that states it very well. So I'm thinking about why I go to church, what I accomplish. I kind of think of it in a way that Jim Bill McIntyre once wrote. Does anyone doubt it? The scriptures teach where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. It's a universal law. You look forward to your vacation. You labor to make every detail joyous. But in the latter days of your vacation, it's easy to turn thoughts homeward where your treasure is. A little later, he says, you see others drive to their places of worship, but there's a distinctive trip you make. It's to your home congregation. It's special. It's home. It's my favorite spot. And here in peace, truth, and serenity, I worship God with my brothers and sisters. He's my treasure. This is my home. This is the joy of my heart. That's a healthy reason for going to church. So it might be said, really, that a person should go to church because he wants to in order to please God. And then that these three thoughts we've offered are what will be accomplished when one goes to church to please God. We'll remember and thank. We'll be an influence and be influenced. We'll express our identity and our unity in offering up spiritual sacrifices to God. We recognize, I think, that this calls for a particular kind of faith and in particular ways. Do I believe there's someone greater than myself? Do I believe that life is about something more than just money I make and recreation I enjoy? Do I think I need other people? All of those require a particular kind of faith, but really it boils down to one thing, a choice. A choice continually reaffirmed. A choice to make the Lord and His people a priority. A choice to begin a week with what comes first. So, I ask of myself, do I have that kind of faith? I hope you'll ask yourself too. Maybe this is a habit you've gotten out of, and we need to pray about it and get back on track. Maybe it's just a word of encouragement to what we already know. Maybe it's a thought we didn't know. Either way, I hope you'll be helped by it. If in some way you need to respond to the Lord's invitation this morning, please come here to John while we stand and sing together.